There we go. I can hear myself and everything. Blacksmith helping me out tonight. It's my second night running the board. I apologize in advance for if I accidentally flip us over to some kind of Russian broadcast. You know, just yesterday I was listening to a podcast called Hardcore History, where they were talking about some Japanese soldiers during World War II. And this is really interesting stuff. So apparently there was a handful of Japanese soldiers that were distributed throughout the Philippines right around 1943, where commanding officers deployed them out to these islands and said, you do everything within your power to keep the Allies out of here. And one of these guys did not end his assignment until 1979. He continued fighting World War II into the late 70s. And the Japanese government did everything they could to convince this guy that the war was over. Through great expense, they had family members flown out to this island. They brought stacks of newspapers from, like, say, 1949 to 1952. And when this guy finally left the island and wrote a book, he said that he assumed these newspapers were propaganda because they spoke about Japan flourishing and rebounding. And he said they had to be a lie because if Japan lost the war, they would have fought to every last man, woman, and child. There would have been no Japan had they lost the war. And he continued to fight. And the reason this was bothering people is because whenever the locals would go anywhere near this guy, he would kill a bunch of them. And what's interesting to me is he wasn't the only one. There was another group of 20 commandos that were deployed in a similar situation, and they kept fighting this war well into the late 50s. There was another guy that they didn't get out of the jungle until 1974. Now, the guy who was there the longest until 1979, they finally had to find his commanding officer, who at this point was an old man working at a floral shop in Japan. So they go into this guy's floral shop and say, hey, we need you to get your uniform out of the closet, and we're going to fly you to the Philippines, and you're going to honorably discharge this guy so he'll stop killing the locals. This guy had to go tell his wife, sweetie, would you mind getting my uniform out of the closet and pressing it and getting my sword ready? Because I need to go out into the woods and tell this guy to stop fighting World War II. Can you imagine what your wife would have to say to you? She would just assume you're having an affair and this was some elaborate plot. But this really happened. This guy was flown out to the middle of the jungle. The full Japanese, you know, it's quite a bit more grandiose than what we're used to in America. He goes out into the woods. He calls this guy out of his cave. Apparently, he had a second in command with him. So this guy had company this whole time who believed the same thing he did, that this war wasn't over, that this was all propaganda, all these newspapers being left. And so this guy goes. He presents him with the sword. I guess the thing is, you know, your commanding officer hands you the sword, says you are honorably discharged from this army. And then the guy hands him the sword back, and it's sort of done, and he left. And he spent the rest of his life trying to explain to people how he continued to fight World War II until 1979. You got to think, Vietnam had ended by then. A lot of things had happened. This guy missed a lot of life. But that was the mentality of Japan at that time. There was this weird sort of mass, I don't call it propaganda, but there was this idea where they romanticized the notion of the samurai warrior and sort of used that to fuel a society into thinking that's who we are in Japan. We fight to the last man with the last rifle, with the last bullet. And, you know, the phrase going around was, you know, 50 million for the cause, or whatever the population of Japan was at the time. Every last human being with every last breath in their body would fight till there was either no Japan left or they had won the war. And he just didn't believe it when people told him that the war had ended. So strange. You got to think, how did they spend their time other than just occasionally killing some poor natives who were out looking for coconuts or something? What did they do? What did they convince themselves was happening? Were they making booby traps like Rambo? I don't know. But what's fascinating to me is the extent to which the human mind can be bent. It gets onto a certain path, you know, and in our everyday life, we trust our own minds. We trust that we're going to go to the grocery store, and when we get in the checkout line, we're going to see the checkout boy or girl with a smile on their face putting stuff into a bag, and we're not going to see like a fire-breathing dragon. But almost certainly, at least once in this world, someone has seen that. And their reality was that, some nightmare, some horror movie. And we could all go down that road. It's just one car accident away, one brain tumor away. Something will happen that changes the course of our minds, and you trust your mind with everything. And what happens when your mind is no longer trustworthy and you continue to fight a war for 25 years after it ended? So the main focus of tonight is going to be murder, murder ballads, and more importantly, America's first school shooting. So when you want to look at one date in a timeline and you want to understand what people were going through, you don't look at that year. Let's say in this particular instance, we're going to look at a date from the end of January 1979. When you want to gain empathy for what people were going through in January 29, 1979, you don't look at the year 1979 because it hadn't happened yet. You look at the year 1978. That was what people had lived. That's what they experienced. They hadn't yet begun to sort of dig the hole that was going to be 1979 or live that year yet. So to give you a frame of reference, I always look at music. I look at the music and the films of the preceding year leading up to the date I'm thinking about, and that's what was happening. So in 1978, of the top 10 singles, that's radio singles, you know, pop songs that sold the most copies and were the most popular for that entire year, two of them were by Andy Gibb and two of them were by the Bee Gees. And if you don't know who Andy Gibb is, God bless you. You've probably lived a better life than I have. But Andy Gibb is the talented younger brother of the two Gibb brothers who were in the Bee Gees. And this was an era of disco. If you got in your car and turned on the radio, unless you had your favorite FM rock station, you were probably going to hear Andy Gibb or the Bee Gees because they had four of the top 10 songs for the year on lockdown. Film-wise, probably the big hit of 1978 would have been the film adaptation of Grease, the musical. The film version, of course, had John Travolta. And that spawned a hit of its own, the song called You're the One That I Want. I'm sure you remember it. It's the one where they sing the chorus really fast. You're the one that I want. You can hardly understand what they're saying. But that was a huge hit at the time. It wasn't top 10, but it was a big hit pretty much all year long. Another notable thing as you bring 1978 to a close was the Star Wars Holiday Special. Now, if you've never seen that, it's sort of become a favorite in university towns. It was on NBC, but it was just a major network broadcast special that showed in the evening, November 17th, 1978, to be exact, where Star Wars had been so huge the previous year that a major network said, let's make a Star Wars holiday special. And it was bad. It was so bad, in fact, that to this day, college town little independent video stores have copies of it to rent out to people so that they can just watch it and laugh at how unintentionally funny it is. I think I saw it when I was 19, you know, renting from I Love Video or whatever, you know, whatever the hip video store is for all the underground stuff. And it's ridiculous. It's Chewbacca goes home to his family who lives in a tree, and it's like Mrs. Chewbacca has like an apron on and she's making Christmas cookies, and there's little Chewbaccas, like little Chewies. And it's crazy. And, you know, all your favorites are there. Harrison Ford is there. Carrie Fisher. And they're all singing holiday songs, and you've got stormtroopers with Christmas hats on, and it's every hardcore Star Wars fan's nightmare. It's like if you imagine the world's biggest Star Wars fan having like 105 fever, dying of the flu, and having the worst fever dream in the history of fever dreams. The Star Wars holiday special is what he would have dreamed. In fact, when I was reading about it and reminding myself of how stupid the whole thing was, I thought that special alone, if you argued it in court, is almost a justifiable cause for homicide. You could almost say that taking someone's life shortly after seeing the Star Wars holiday special, you might just get probation. I don't know. I'm not a paralegal. I don't know for sure. But that brings us to the date I'm interested in. So to give you a little background of the main character in this story, it's Miss Brenda Spencer. She was born April 3rd, 1962. She lived in the San Carlos neighborhood of San Diego, California. in a house that was directly across the street from Grover Cleveland Elementary School, where she went to elementary school. Physically, she was about 5 foot two at the age of 16, probably weighed 105 pounds, soaking wet, had brassy red hair, and was a very pale girl. You know, if you ever watched that cartoon Daria, she was probably a girl that Daria would have hung out with. She wore a knitted stocking cap, wore her clothes kind of baggy, but was just a waifish redheaded girl. She would later say that she identified herself as homosexual pretty much since birth, which is a weird thing to say. How do you identify anything at birth? But she believed herself to be gay. I don't know what that has to do with anything, but it gets brought up a lot when you look through her legal paperwork, basically what's available online. So at this point in her life, her parents had separated. There was a custody dispute, and the dad won custody, which is kind of unusual, but they say he didn't want to pay his ex child support, but he was able to afford the lawyer he needed. And at that time, the courts were kind of going back and forth with who they were siding with. It hadn't quite become the norm yet that they would always be given to the mom with the dad having certain visitation. It was just kind of bouncing back and forth. So he ends up with the kids. He doesn't have much money, though. They were kind of house poor. They had a decent house, but supposedly there was barely a stick of furniture in the place. There were just a couple of mattresses on the floor and some empty liquor bottles everywhere. So not the happiest home. Acquaintances said that she expressed, this girl, Brenda Spencer, expressed hostility. She would often joke about how she wanted to shoot a policeman or wanted to do something big to get on television. And she did have some signs of ability, though. She apparently was quite good at photography, and she had won a contest at the school that was put on by the Humane Society. It was a competition for best photograph having to do with a certain subject. But otherwise, she was generally uninterested in school. One teacher recalled that he would frequently have to ask her if she was awake, and basically she was unengaged. She later, once she was incarcerated, there was a series of tests ran on her, and it was discovered that she had an injury to the temporal lobe of her brain. This is fascinating to me because if you think of Charles Whitman, the guy who climbed to the top of the UT Tower and ended so many lives tragically, when he had his autopsy, a giant tumor was found in his brain. And a lot of people like to think of what if these tumors or these injuries not existed in the brain, would these people have been capable of such incredible aggression? So now we're getting to the aggression part. On the morning of January 29th, 1979, the elementary school children and the teachers and the faculty of Grover Cleveland Elementary in San Diego were sort of getting ready for the day. You got to think it's just a month after Christmas break. Everybody's kind of still reeling from their Christmas, getting back into the groove. A lot of eyewitnesses said it was already kind of an eerie morning. There was an exceptional amount of frost on the ground. The sky was kind of hazy and gray, and it's about 5 minutes till the bell's about to ring. So the principal goes over to the gate. He's unlocked it. The kids are lining up. The teachers, you know, this is elementary school. The teachers are helping these kids line up and get into their place, waiting for the bell to ring. And then all of a sudden, you start hearing these things that sound like firecrackers. Now, it's 1979. It is not at all inconceivable that a kid got a cap gun for Christmas and might have been shooting it off. This would not be a weird thing in 1979 or even in 1985. If you're too young to remember cap guns, they were basically realistic-looking firearms that were loaded with these paper strips that sort of fed you rounds into the gun, and the hammer would blast against this, what is probably just a small amount of black gunpowder, or the equivalent of a small firecracker, and it would make a bang sound and produce smoke and an interesting odor, and it's the kind of thing you couldn't get away with selling now. It's ridiculous. They looked so much like real guns, and they produced a discharge that sounded just like a gun going off, but it was quiet. It didn't sound like heavy gunfire, so everyone just assumed someone has a cap gun, someone has fireworks. All of a sudden, the principal starts clutching his chest, and people can see that he's got a fresh wound and it's bleeding. No sooner do they see that than there are children screaming out with fresh wounds of their own and blood coming out of their own wounds. And you have to put yourself in that place in time. There had never been a school shooting. When Charles Whitman climbed to the top of the UT Tower, school was out. This was a university. He was shooting at Young adults, yes, and I believe one woman did lose an unborn child in the massacre, but he was mostly shooting at faculty, adults, whether it be young adults or older adults. This wasn't a guy walking into a school and killing children. That horror hadn't yet played out in America. There had been a few instances where a student may have gone into a school and shot like the headmaster or something. There have been one or two of those, but a school shooting as we know them, so commonplace now, hadn't existed yet. So people's brains didn't have a go-to. They hadn't compartmentalized enough to like be, oh yeah, that's what this is. Let's hit the deck. So it took them a little while to realize someone was opening fire on the school. That, you know, they're thinking, oh, maybe there's a bank robbery and we're caught in the crossfire of the police and some criminals. They just didn't know what to think. But it finally came clear. These kids were getting shot. Luckily, the 22 rounds aren't the kind of round that's going to, you know, blow your chest wide open. It's going to create a nasty wound. If you get hit in the right place, you're going to die. But basically, it's a squirrel hunting gun. And Brenda had been bought this as a Christmas gift by her dad. Her dad bought her a 22 repeating rifle and 400 rounds of ammunition. And the type of rifle this was, it had a little magazine that would hold a certain number of rounds, maybe 10 or 20, and you shove it in there, you shoot till it's empty, and then you reload the magazine. And this is the kind of rifle you would buy a youngster. It has no recoil. You can just hold it out and shoot. It's not going to bruise your shoulder. The sound is not so alarming that it deafens you. It's just a firecracker sound. And the kind of recoil that wouldn't even bother an 8-year-old kid. Just not much snapback to the rifle. So this girl just basically opens up her window, gets all of her ammunition there, and starts shooting at what she later said was anyone wearing her favorite colors. So if you were a kid who got a new winter coat for Christmas that year and it was blue, well, you were in for a bad day because that was one of her favorite colors and she was going to target you. So they finally figure out what's happening after hours of this. They've got the kids run for cover. At this point, the school custodian, head custodian had died. The principal had died. A dozen other kids were in the hospital with pretty serious wounds. But they had gotten everyone sort of undercover, and the police had isolated the house. And they surrounded it, and they started yelling at her through a bullhorn, "What are you doing? What in the world is wrong with you? What's happening? What can we do to stop this?" Realizing you're talking to a 16-year-old girl. No one had even conceived of anything this weird before, so they're not quite sure what to say, and they don't want to throw grenades in the house because she's a child herself. So finally, a cop gets her on the phone. He calls her home phone, and he says, "Brenda, what is the matter with you? Why on earth are you doing this? You're shooting children." And she says, "I don't like Mondays. This livens up the day for me." And this is the most bizarre thing. And there are cops who quit the police force because of what this girl did. It messed with their heads so much that a human being could be so young and so cold to just say, "I don't like Mondays." So now let's go halfway across the country. There's a radio station in Georgia where a young Bob Geldof is sitting there waiting to be interviewed. His band, the Boomtown Rats, an Irish band, had just put out their second album, and they're on tour in the U.S., and they're a pretty cool new wave band. You know, they had had one hit single. They were doing all right. They were touring the States, and he's sitting waiting to be interviewed. And he sees this, what do they call them, the telex machine, which is like an ancient fax machine. It took an hour to spit out one page, and it smelled like burning rubber. But he sees this telex machine pushing out the news for these DJs to read. These disc jockeys would read the hourly news. And he sees it, and of course, it's abbreviated. Girl in San Diego shoots at elementary school, asked why, says, "I don't like Mondays." And he's floored by this. And he hears some of the females working in the radio office screaming like, "Oh my God, can you believe this?" He hears the disc jockey reading it off on the news hour. A young woman shoots at elementary school kids and tells the cops she did it because she doesn't like Mondays. And if you don't know Bob Geldof, if you've ever seen the movie Pink Floyd, The Wall, he played Pink in that movie. He was also the spark that sort of got this concert going called Live Aid, which is the biggest concert in history. It happened in 1985. It was for relief of a lot of people in Africa, and it featured some of the most notorious live performances of all time, not the least of which was Queen. They sort of made their comeback performance there. But Live Aid was this huge concert that went on to 300,000 people and was broadcast all over the world. That's Bob Geldof. He is a celebrity in his own right. He's had an interesting life. But at the time, he was the singer for a cool new wave band. So he wrote this song, I Don't Like Mondays, which was about this girl and about her story and how absurd the whole thing was. And you have to think, this, there was no 48-hour news cycle at the time. This was news for years. Nothing even, you know, Columbine was 15 years away. Nothing close to this happened anywhere near this time. So it was fresh on people's minds. There were news stories running over and over again about this. And the Boomtown Rats, which was Bob Geldof's band, on their third album, they put this song out as a single. And this was November of that same year. So the shooting in January, by November of that same year, I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats was a hit single in 30 different countries. It was the fourth biggest selling single in the United Kingdom for the year 1979. It was a hit, pretty much a global phenomenon. Now, the DJs in San Diego refused to play it out of respect for the families. But there's no escaping a hit single. After the DJs didn't play it for a year or so, it got heavy rotation on all the stations that would basically pay the hits. You know, there are all, you can hear them now, like Bob FM, whatever. We're just going to play every song that was in the top 10 for the past however many years. So the people who were victims at the school shooting would get into their cars to go to the store with their moms and hear this song that was pretty much word for word describing what happened to them on that day. These kids that grew up to be adults would go to their jobs, and when they're in the office and people have got those little radios on their desks, they would hear this song. And they talk about it over and over again, how surreal it is that there was a hit song, and it was a good song. And they never were able to escape that day because of this song. It's just too bizarre. So tonight we're going to play Murder Ballads, but this first song doesn't really qualify. But it is the song that was written about this incident, and it's the whole thing that got me thinking about this show we're going to do tonight. So I'm going to figure out which one of these brings up music. It's probably this one. I'm going to play this song.
Stopped in the playground now, She wants to play with the toys a while. And school's out early, and soon we'll be learning. And the lesson today is how to die. And then the bullhorn crackles, and the captain tackles with the problems of the house and wife. And he can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reason do you need to die? Die, oh, oh. And the silicon chip inside a head gets switched to overload. Oh, and nobody's gonna go to school today. She's gonna make them stay at home. And daddy doesn't understand it. He always said she was good as gold. And he can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reason do you need to be shown? Tell me why. I don't like Mondays.
Tell me why.
I don't like Mondays.
Tell me why.
I don't like.
Tell me why.
I don't like Mondays.
Tell me why.
I don't like.
Tell me why.
I don't like Mondays.
Tell me why.
I don't like Mondays. I wanna shoot. The whole day down.
Sometimes, of course, the thought of there being so many other poets writing cannot but seep in, however much one may try to keep it at bay by reading nothing since Beowulf. Then one may grow rather shrill. I would rather be sad than shrill, and I will sing the next poem, which is about a little child who got tired of being told he was only one of many. So he threw his fellows in a ditch and got hanged for it.
You are only one of many in a small account, if any. You think about yourself too much. This touched the child with a quick touch and worked his mind to such a pitch he threw his fellows in a ditch. This little child who was so mild is grown too wild. Murder in the first degree, and cried old fury, recording the verdict of the jury. Now we come to the execution tree, the gallows stand wide on me, Christ died for sinners, explained the prison chaplain from his miscellany. Weeping bitterly, the little child cried, I die. Of many.
Vic Chestnut, One of Many. That's actually an exact recitation of a poem by Stevie Smith. If you don't know her, she was an author. She wrote some novels in the 30s. The novels were pretty good, but I was a big fan of her poetry, still am. Her first volume of poetry which had illustrations in it. It's really cool, almost like if you've ever seen Daniel Johnston's drawings that he did, those really fun, really silly drawings. He did something similar, but back in the 30s. The first book was called A Good Time Was Had by All. It came out in 1937, and it sort of established her on the scene as a poet. She wasn't born Stevie Smith, but she actually used the name Stevie Smith so that she could sell more books and be taken as a man. I guess at the time you were more likely to sell if people thought you were a male poet rather than a female poet, which is interesting. Pretty soon her poems were found all throughout all kinds of interesting periodicals. Her style was often very dark, and her characters were perpetually saying goodbye to each other and their friends and welcoming death. That poem, One of Many, is an account of an actual story of a young boy in England who was constantly acting out in his grammar school. And the teacher would, I guess, try to impress upon him that he wasn't that important. He wasn't significant. He was just one of many. And he grew frustrated with hearing that. So he basically ended up throwing a couple of his classmates into a ditch. And I guess the fall broke their necks and killed them. And he was executed publicly. The perpetrator of this, the young man who got tired of being told he was only one of many, ended up getting hung for his crime. So that fits right into Stevie Smith's poetry. And it was, of course, sung beautifully by Vic Chestnut. The little audio spoken word thing you heard before that was an old recording of Stevie Smith's voice. That's why it had all the pops and hisses. It was recorded on a very early technology. I guess there was some audio of her talking about her poetry and reading some of them. So we're going to keep the talk short from here on since that first bit was so long. I'm going to try to play as many songs as possible. So the next song up is called Murderer. Surprise, surprise, by the band Low. And it goes a little something like this.
Must have more important. Did you know that you can support Co-op Radio when you use Ride Austin? Nonprofit Ride Austin, created with Austin values in mind, helps harness the giving spirit of the Austin community. When you ride local with Ride Austin, you can round up your fare and designate Co-op Radio to receive your donation. For more information and to download the Ride Austin app, you may visit rideaustin.com.
Underwriting with co-ops is a lot about you and your business. As a co-op underwriter, you join a community of people who are passionate about public radio. When you invest in co-op, you are investing in a station that informs, educates, and entertains. Find out more about becoming an underwriter and supporting community radio by calling 512-472-1369 or go online to koop.org.
Okay, those were fun announcements. So before that, we had Low with Murderer. And the next one we're going to get into is Murder in the Red Barn by Tom Waits off his album Bow Machine. I want to apologize to Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds if you guys are listening tonight. First of all, that's awesome that you're listening. But if you are, I really wanted to play a Nick Cave song. I know he put out a whole album of murder ballads, and then every other album he's ever put out has had at least one or two songs about murder. But there's a certain flavor to a Nick Cave murder ballad that is similar to the way Tom Waits approaches it. And I wanted to hit as many different angles as possible, so I had to kind of pick between doing a Tom Waits number or Nick Cave. So next time, Nick Cave. Sorry about that, buddy. The next one we're going to get into here is Murder in the Red Barn by Tom Waits.
A murder in the red barn. in the autumn. Digging in the rain will bring all this gloom. There's nothing wrong with a lady drinking alone in a room. But there was a murder in the Red Barn. A murder in the Red Barn. There was a murder in the Red Barn. Murder in the Red Barn. Came to tell my story to all these young and eager minds. Look in their unspoiled faces and their curious bright eyes. Stories of corruption, crime, and killing, yes, it's true. Greed and fixed elections, guns and drugs and whores and booze. Been a while since I put on a suit of my own clothes, and even longer since I cast my shadow on a church house door. They say every sin is deadly, but I believe they may be wrong. I'm guilty of all seven, I don't feel too bad at all. And I used to have a wad of $100 bills in the back pocket of my suit. I had a 45 underneath my coat and another one in my boot. I drove a big old Cadillac, bought a new one anytime I pleased. And I put more lawmen in the ground than Alabama put cotton seed. I spent a few years on vacation, sanctioned by the state I mentioned. But see, a man like me don't do no time, too hard to come back from. The meanest of the mean you see, you lock away and toss the key. They're just loudmouth punks to me, have scraped meaner off my shoe. Somewhere I ain't saying there's a hole that holds a judge. The last one that I dug myself, and I must admit I was. Sad to lay him in it, but I did the best I could. Once his honor grows a conscience, well, folks out there just ain't no good. And there's a pretty girl out there, said, Daddy, you stay cool tonight. All I need from you is to come home and be here by my side. Say what you gotta say to shut their Bibles and their mouths. If there was to tie a noose, they'd have to lay their Bibles down. We'll be right back. I ain't here to save no souls, and even if I could, I could never save enough to put back half the ones I took. So if they rest in torment, you can't say it's 'cause of me. They'd long been bought and paid for like that fool's in Tennessee. I used to have a wad of $100 bills in the back pocket of my suit. I had a 45 underneath my coat and another one in my boot. I drove a big old Cadillac, bought a new one anytime I please. And I put more lawmen in the ground than Alabama put cotton seed. And there's a pretty girl out there, said, "Daddy, you stay cool tonight. All I need from you is to come home and be here by my side. Say what you gotta say to shut their Bibles in their mouths. If there was to tie a noose, they'd have to lay their Bibles down."
Right, Cotton Seed by the Drive-By Truckers, song written by Mike Cooley. It's one of my favorites. It's basically about a guy who spent his life killing policemen, I guess. So it's got that great line in it, "I put more lawmen in the ground than Alabama put cotton seed." Another good line about how he had to take the life of a judge who suddenly grew a conscience. But that's more in line with the history of Americana and murder ballads. So murder ballads is an actual subgenre of the traditional ballad form, and it deals with crime. Typically, it's a lyrical narrative that describes events leading up to a murder, often including the direct aftermath, and then also refers to the sort of pursuit of law and being captured and the regrets, and maybe it went down in a way that you fell in love with a guy or a girl and the two of you just got crazy or turned on something crazy inside one another and you robbed a bank together, or maybe you were down on your luck and you're about to lose your farm or you're about to be evicted from your home and you did something nuts that you regret and you wish you could take it back, but you can't. Once you take a life, you're kind of in it. And eventually you're going to be tried by a jury of your peers and you're going to pay the price. And even if you do escape mentally, you're going to pay the price. One way or another, you're going to be behind bars, whether it be physical or mental. So it's an interesting thing. There are certainly murder ballads that exist outside of the culture of the United States, but man, do we have some good ones here. Some really good ones. Before that, we had, of course, Tom Waits with "Murder in the Red Barn." Like he says, there's always some kind of killing you got to do around the farm. And my favorite lyric from that song has to be, "There's nothing wrong with a lady drinking alone in a room." I don't know why that lyric just resonates with me every time we hear it. So the next track we're going to hear is from Bruce Springsteen. He put out an album called Nebraska in 1980. And it was basically a demo album. It was just him in some old house with a two-track recorder, and he recorded all these songs with just him, an acoustic guitar, maybe a mandolin, and he played it for some people, and he said, "What do you think of this demo?" And they're like, "You're crazy. This is an album." So he puts it out. In between The River and Born in the USA, he puts out this sparse, incredibly dark folk album that is about half murder ballads. The opening track is a folk song that is sort of a celebration of the movie Badlands, which is about a young couple that go on a killing spree. And it's very interesting and very heady stuff. The track we're going to play from Nebraska tonight is called Johnny 99, and it fits that murder ballad thing perfectly. It's a regular guy down on his luck, about to lose his mortgage to the bank, lost his job at the plant, and he went crazy, went and shot a night clerk, and got sentenced to 99. The judge says, we'll sentence you to 98 in a year, and we'll call it even, Johnny 99. So here we go, Johnny 99, Bruce Springsteen.
Well, they closed down the auto plant in Mawa late that month. Ralph went out looking for a job, but he couldn't find none. He came home too drunk from mixing Tanqueray and wine. He got a gunshot at night clerk, now they call him Johnny 99. Down in the part of town where if you hit a red light, you don't stop. Waving his gun around and threatening to blow his top. When an off-duty cop snuck up on him from behind, out in front of the club tip-top, slapped the cuffs on Johnny 99. Well, the city supplied a public defender, but the judge, mean John Brown, he came into the courtroom and stared poor Johnny. For 98 in a year, and we'll call it even Johnny 99. Mama stood up and shouted, Judge, don't take my boy this way. Well, son, you got any statement you'd like to make before the bailiff comes forever take you away? Now, Judge, Judge, I got this honest man could be. The bank was holding my mortgage, you're taking my house away. Now, I ain't saying that made me an innocent man, but it was more than all this that put that gun in my hand. Well, Your Honor, I do believe I'd be better off dead. And if you can take a man's life for the thoughts that's in his head, then won't you sit back in that chair, think it over, Judge, one more time. Let him shave off my hair.